This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, June 19th. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The U.S. executes the second convicted murderer in 38 years. Juan Raul Garza is dead by lethal injection. An American writer on trial again in Peru. Is she a gringa terrorist or the innocent victim of the Peruvian military? And Washington puts a lid on wholesale energy prices, but will it stop the blackouts or fix the prices? We'll have a report. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. If the Bush administration is dead set on unilaterally going ahead with the space-based missile plan, Russian President Putin says he will respond appropriately. Phil Itner reports from Moscow.
Speaking in a rare audience with American journalists, Vladimir Putin said that if the United States goes ahead with a national missile defense program, Russia will be forced to respond with an escalation of its nuclear arsenal. Specifically, Putin said Russia would develop more multiple warhead missiles that could strike several targets at once, thereby evading any missile shield. While acknowledging that there is little that impoverished Russia can do to deter the U.S., Putin said Russia would be working closely with China in response to American moves on missile defense. Putin has said that any future nuclear threats from rogue states or terrorists is far outweighed by the threat of a breakdown in the stability that years of arms negotiations have developed. Phil Itner for Free Speech Radio News, Moscow.
Protesting and acts of civil disobedience continue today in Vieques, Puerto Rico, where the United States is in day two of this month's practice maneuvers. Since the beginning of the exercises on Monday, 30 people have been arrested for acts of civil disobedience. Shannon Novak reports from Vieques.
Last night, about 150 people peacefully protested outside the Navy's main gates to Camp Garcia. Protesters vowed to continue entering the restricted land in an effort to temporarily suspend the Navy's maneuvers. Manuel Rodriguez Orellana is the Puerto Rico Independence Party's Secretary for North American Relations.
Civil disobedience does not end tonight. Civil disobedience will go on. And stay tuned, and tomorrow there will be more civil disobedience. And they cannot deal with this issue until they stop the bombing immediately and permanently.
Among those arrested yesterday was Jacqueline Jackson. In a press statement, her husband, Reverend Jesse Jackson, said, "We urge the president to respond with immediate cessation of bombing on Vieques." The Navy has used the Vieques range for 60 years. The use of inert ordnance, or dummy bombs, began last year. Practice maneuvers have caused extensive environmental damage and heavy metal contamination. An elevated cancer rate is unofficially linked to the practice. The government of Puerto Rico insists on the Navy's immediate withdrawal and environmental cleanup. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shannon Novak in Vieques, Puerto Rico.
The Democrats are ready to do battle with the president over what the bipartisan group are calling a patient's bill of rights. Nicole Hallett has more from the Capitol.
Republican John McCain joined the Democratic Senate leadership to launch a bipartisan push for the McCain-Kennedy-Edwards Patient's Bill of Rights. Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle stressed Democrats' determination to pass their version of the bill, despite opposition from the White House and the insurance industry.
If you have health care, you ought to have rights. And as a last resort, you should have the right to hold a health plan accountable for its decisions if they are harmful. After all, a right without a remedy is no right at all.
Senator McCain shared Daschle's enthusiasm for the bill and warned its detractors that he will let nothing stand in the way of the bill's passage.
We want a bill the President of the United States will sign. We stand ready to negotiate and discuss any issue with the opponents of this bill. Let's not let the special interests and the big money gridlock this legislation for the sake of 170 million Americans.
From the United States Capitol, this is Nicole Hallett for Free Speech Radio News.
It's been confirmed. Mad cow disease is now in Eastern Europe. Charles Michael Ray reports from Prague.
The Czech Ministry of Agriculture is testing all cattle in the country over the age of 30 months for mad cow disease after three independent tests confirmed the presence of BSE in a six-year-old cow from a Czech farm. 134 cattle from the same farm were slaughtered as a precautionary measure but tested negative for the disease. Spokesperson for the Ministry of Agriculture, Hugo Rolden, says BSE likely entered the country through tainted milk that was fed to Czech cows in the 90s, or through residual contamination in a mill where bone meal feed for pigs was processed in the same machines as cattle feed. The Ministry of Agriculture insists that Czech beef is safe for consumers. Under Czech law, the spine and head are separated from cows before they are processed to reduce the risk of contamination. Roldan says the ministry believes that only a small number of cows are infected with BSE in the Czech Republic. They estimate at worst-case scenario 100 cows have the disease. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Prague.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Juan Raul Garza is dead. He's responsible for killing three people and for running a marijuana smuggling operation in Brownsville, Texas. This morning at 7:09, the U.S. Bureau of Prisons put him to death by lethal injection. His execution occurred with a tiny fraction of the media attention that Timothy McVeigh's death received 8 days ago. But the execution did bring victim family members and abolitionists to Terre Haute. Rennie McKay reports from Terre Haute, Indiana, on this second execution since the de facto moratorium on federal executions ended in 1963.
Terre Haute today is a much different town than it was just a few days ago. The masses of media are gone. 1,300 fewer journalists covered this execution than covered Timothy McVeigh's execution. But the scene in the death chamber didn't change much. According to Harley Lappin, the warden of the penitentiary, the execution proceeded without incident, just as it did last week. But last week's execution still lingered in the air.
The court order to execute inmate Juan Garza has been fulfilled. Pursuant to the sentence of the United States District Court in the Southern District of Texas, Juan Raul Garza has been executed by lethal injection. He was pronounced dead at 7:09 a.m. Central Daylight Time. Garza's body has been released to a representative of his family.
Execution by lethal injection involves three drugs. The first is a sedative, the second stops breathing, and the third stops the heart. Most of those watching the execution were members of the media. Only four members of the families of victims attended, and none of Garza's family attended, although they were in Terre Haute. Karen Hensel of Wish TV in Indianapolis recounts Garza's final words.
He said, "I want to say that I'm sorry. I apologize for all the pain and grief that I caused. I ask for your forgiveness. I ask for your forgiveness. And God bless." And at that point, he did somewhat of a sigh, just like it was over.
For Noel Espinoza from the Brownsville Herald, the execution wasn't what he expected.
I've seen violent deaths before, actually people killing each other or even killing themselves by accident. And but this was beyond one's imagination. Seemed like he fell in a deep sleep, and there was hardly any emotions at all. And I think it was more like, I call it a structural killing.
One of Garza's lawyers, Greg Wirchok, spoke after the official press conference.
Juan Garza's execution has left his four children without a father. I do not have an answer when I'm asked about the families devastated by Juan Garza's crimes.
The three men Garza killed or had killed are Thomas Rumbo, Gilberto Matos, and Erasmo de la Fuente. Their family members who attended spoke with selected members of the media, including Noel Espinoza, and told him they do still feel some anger.
They thought that, you know, justice was done, that he deserved, you know, what he got because he killed this relative. And they felt that coming over here, you know, would somehow start the healing process, that they would... It is over now after 11 years, and somehow they feel that now, you know, they're going to leave this behind or try.
For Wirchok, this execution was still unjustified. He says there are too many flaws in the justice system, and he cites the drug kingpin law enacted in 1988 that sent Garza into the federal prison system.
Just the fact that from the period from 88 to 94, there was only the drug kingpin statute as a federal death penalty crime at that time, and there were only five federal capital prosecutions in the entire state of Texas during that period, and all five were against Hispanics. So I do think that definitely race played a factor, and certainly the fact of the geographic disparities and the fact that that the federal death penalty is still really a traditional death belt punishment, a southern sort of punishment rather than a uniform, consistent punishment across the United States.
Warchalk is also upset that his appeals to the Supreme Court were rejected. He says the appeal, which says the U.S. violated an international human rights treaty that it has ratified, was valid.
Focused on the issue regarding the use of what we call unadjudicated offenses at its sentencing phase. These were four murders from Mexico that Mr. Garza was never arrested for, never charged with, never tried, convicted, or sentenced. And that was the issue on which the tribunal found that it was a violation of his human rights and the U.S.'s obligations under the OAS Charter.
Any problems in the case were in the way the system chose Garza for the death penalty, because he never did deny he ordered the killing of the three men. And it was the system that brought abolitionists out to the prison to stand vigil and pray for the victims of violence, both state-administered and individually. But the system did not change for Juan Raul Garza. His remains are being transported to Brownsville. In Terre Haute, I'm Rennie McKay for Free Speech Radio News.
In Washington, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission expanded an earlier order to cap wholesale energy prices to 24 hours a day until September of 2002. In April, the commission authorized price caps only during severe power shortages. Observers say political pressure prompted the commission to act as California's Governor Gray Davis prepares to testify before a congressional hearing in Washington this week. Many question how the FERC intends to enforce the price caps, while consumer advocates complain the mandate will not stop the rolling blackouts nor effectively fix prices. Cata Mester reports from Sacramento.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, issued an order to expand price caps to 24 hours a day. But California's Governor Gray Davis says the commission's price plan doesn't go far enough.
The FERC has finally taken a step in the right direction, but there's much more they should do. For one thing, Californians have been overcharged billions of dollars for electricity. To date, we've not received 1 cent in refunds. Secondly, this order may well have some loopholes, as the first one did. If that's the case, they need to be closed immediately.
The Regulatory Commission's order will limit prices to the cost of producing energy at the state's most expensive power plants. Consumer advocates like Doug Heller of the Foundation for Taxpayers' Rights fear that the FERC order will not bring prices down. Heller says the FERC plan will give power plants an incentive to boost their profits by running plants inefficiently. Under the FERC plan, price caps are not fixed. Mike Florio, senior attorney for the Utility Reform Network, or TURN, says the new order permits generators to justify prices above the price cap.
The order does provide that a plant can bid above the cap and be paid above the cap, subject to having to justify to FERC that their costs require that. So a big question is, how many people will go that route, and how vigorous will FERC be about overseeing those supposed justifications? Because it has the potential to turn into a big loophole if they don't do anything and people figure out you can charge more than the cap and there aren't any consequences. So that's one of those things where you really have to see how it's implemented to know how effective it's going to be.
Members of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission say the expanded order to cap energy prices will close loopholes allowed by their April order. Florio of the Utility Reform Network says it remains to be seen how effective the order will be to curb abuses by power generators.
As far as how effective it's going to be, we really have to be able to dig into the details a little more. It's not clear how effective the order will be in preventing what they call megawatt laundering, which is, you know, selling power multiple times to avoid the price caps. They said that they thought it would address that problem, but we really have to read the actual words and see how they enforce it. But it does seem like, you know, a significant step in the right direction.
If imposed correctly, Florio believes the price caps will cut electricity rates by one-third. But right now, it is not clear how or even if The FERC intends to enforce the new rates. Meanwhile, California's Governor Gray Davis travels to Washington, where he will testify before a congressional committee and meet with two of the most recent FERC appointees. In Washington, the congressional hearings are already underway. California Democratic Congressman Bradley Sherman says Democratic lawmakers will continue to push for more restrictive price caps.
Last December, last November, in each case, if FERC won't regulate this, then we in Congress ought to pass a law that gives California the right to do so. And when I say regulate, I mean really regulate. And as I explained earlier, that means setting the price of the megawatts produced at each plant based on the costs of operating that plant and recovering the costs of building that plant and, of course, a reasonable profit.
And in Sacramento, California lawmakers aren't wasting any time. Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante supported legislation in committee today to make price manipulation a felony.
Some of the folks who are testifying here are representing industries who said there is no amendment that could be made to this bill that would remove their opposition. In fact, they're so opposed to this bill, I'm not exactly sure why. You would think that they would want to distinguish themselves from the bad actors. But in fact, they somehow, behind closed doors, don't want to do anything to make this bill actually movable. I'm not sure I understand why or how bad it has to get in the state of California before industry decides that they ought to remove some of the bad actors, but we clearly are facing that with this bill.
For Free Speech Radio News in Sacramento, I'm Cuta Mester.
The House and Senate are rolling up their sleeves this week to work out the final details of Bush's education reform plan. The plan, which focuses on high-stakes standardized testing, passed the Senate with bipartisan support last week. And as Gareth Schweitzer reports from Capitol Hill, it's support that has not been weakened by a rider authored by North Carolina Republican Senator Jesse Helms.
The Senate education bill passed recently with a controversial amendment attached that denies federal funds to school districts that exclude the Boy Scouts because of the group's refusal to admit homosexuals. The proposal by North Carolina Republican Jesse Helms was harshly criticized by Chris Labonte, senior advocate at Human Rights Campaign.
It was clear that the intent of his amendment was to be divisive and to single out the Boy Scouts for special treatment. We believe, obviously, the Boy Scouts have served a great role in this country, but we're very upset that they do discriminate based on sexual orientation.
49 senators defended the gay community and voted against the amendment. It appears unlikely, however, that congressional Democrats will make an issue of the amendment once the education bill reaches committee. House Democratic leader Dick Gephardt noted that the party has no plan of action on this issue.
I don't think the amendment is appropriate, and I don't know what the committee will do in the House, and I don't know what the position here will be. We'll just have to wait and see.
Democrats desperately want to finish work on the education bill, which bears a strong Republican imprint and prevents Democrats from focusing the public's attention on their agenda, which includes a patient's bill of rights and a minimum wage increase. Democrats on the conference committee ironing out the details of the education package will likely be loath to stall their own agenda, meaning the gay community could be the losers in their ongoing battle against bigotry in the Boy Scouts. At the Capitol in Washington, D.C., I'm Gareth Schweitzer for Free Speech Radio News.
Lori Berenson, an American who's imprisoned in Lima, Peru, on charges she collaborated with Marxist terrorists in 1996, is awaiting the verdict in her retrial. Trial is a term used lightly in Peru, according to Lori's mother, Rhoda, who says her daughter was simply convicted and imprisoned without jury or evidence of guilt. This time, prosecutors are seeking at least 20 years jail time for the 31-year-old New Yorker who was sentenced to life in 1996 by a hooded military judge as a leader of the leftist rebel group Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement, or MRTA. The ruling was overturned last year and a civilian retrial ordered. Berenson denies all charges against her and says while she shares some of the MRTA's ideological positions, she did not actively assist the group. But most Peruvians who recall 15 years of leftist violence involving the MRTA and the larger Shining Path see Berenson as a gringa terrorist and say she deserves jail. Her mother says the Peruvian press has painted Lori as a monster. The president-elect says Berenson will not receive any special treatment because she is an American. But Rhoda Berenson says it appears to her they have the burden of proof to prove Lori's innocence.
I mean, Peru has signed on to the fact that you are innocent until proven guilty. The Peruvian Constitution says that. yet they started this trial with Laurie behind bars as if she was already a terrorist that had, and society had to be protected from her. And the judge has made numerous statements to the press that, well, she has to convince us of her innocence. And that is not international justice, meeting international standards of justice, where it's compulsory that the system say you are innocent until proven guilty. And that's why they haven't bothered to present evidence to prove her guilty, because they don't think they have to.
When Laurie was given a chance to address the court in March, she sought to, in her words, set the record straight about her innocence. She's scheduled to address the judges again tomorrow. We asked Rhoda what her daughter is planning to say.
Laurie was working as a journalist, and she visited the Peruvian Congress on occasion. There's a charge that said she was helping the LRTA seize Congress, and so she will have statements. I was working very seriously on articles. The magazines that I was writing for have attested to this. If the police hadn't taken and disappeared my computer, the articles I was writing, they would be here as evidence. But I had absolutely nothing to do with the MRTA. I knew nothing about plans. She makes it very clear that she knew two or three people socially by different names, never knew they were members of this group, and never had anything whatsoever to do with this group.
Laurie is now living in a Lima, Peru prison. The prosecutors have also asked for a $5.8 million fine, which the Berensons hope the judges will dismiss. But given the political climate in Peru and the past treatment by the courts, the Berensons are certain an appeal will be in their future.
Even if Laurie is found innocent, the other side will appeal. The appeal process in Peru is almost automatic. So not only can a defendant appeal, but the prosecutor appeal if he doesn't like the sentence. So there's zero probability that Laurie will be walking out with us on Wednesday. Now, the prosecutor said that he's asking for 20 years and not less because Laurie insists she's innocent. This is a country where if you continue to insist you're innocent, you get actually 20 years is both the minimum and maximum penalty. The Peruvian justice system, I believe, is based on the methods and procedures of the Spanish Inquisition, wherein you were told to renounce your beliefs, point to a couple of others, and then the torture on you will be less. If you insist on sticking to your beliefs and insist that you're innocent, we'll give you the maximum torture.
Rhoda Berenson, the mother of American Laurie Berenson, who's imprisoned in Lima, Peru, on charges of terrorism, we spoke with her from Lima. Guinea in West Africa was home for tens of thousands of refugees from Sierra Leone and Liberia for almost a decade. But war has now followed them across the border. Since September last year, rebels have launched attacks from Sierra Leone, killing hundreds and causing refugees to flee their camps. Rory Mulholland reports from the Parrot's Beak area of Southeast Guinea.
I'm Victor Salusini, a Sierra Leonean, but born in Liberia.
Victor is one of almost 200,000 refugees who fled to Guinea in the past decade. They were escaping brutal civil wars in both Sierra Leone and Liberia. Most of them, like Victor, carry terrible memories of the rebels who chased them out of their homeland.
I had a wife called Miata and a single child called Mama Jaka. She was about 6 months old when the rebels met us in Kwendo, Sierra Leone, and they took this baby from her back. So they ordered her to cook this baby, and she cooked this baby, and they sat down at the time of eating, put the gun into her mouth that she couldn't say anything until they got through eating this baby.
Victor's tale of cannibalism is not unique. The Revolutionary United Front, or RUF, rebels of Sierra Leone, were notorious for murdering, raping, and chopping off villagers' limbs. The refugees had been living peacefully in camps in Guinea for years, but war pursued them across the border. Since last September, over 1,000 people have been killed in Guinea in attacks launched by rebels based in Sierra Leone. The Guinean government says President Charles Taylor of Liberia is supporting the rebels. Taylor denies this and in turn accuses Guinea of harboring Liberian dissidents who launch cross-border attacks.
It is a rebel war. Nobody can wield this type of war.
Mamadou Ba is the leader of the opposition in the Guinean parliament. He recommended that Guinean President Lansana Conte negotiate with Charles Taylor.
Unfortunately, the president disagreed. He wanted to fight, even go to Liberia, to Monrovia.
The attacks are usually claimed by a dissident Guinean group, but they're generally believed to be the work of the Revolutionary United Front. Last month, the RUF signed a peace deal with the Sierra Leone government, and its fighters have been handing in their weapons en masse. But the United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, says the situation in Sierra Leone is still too unstable for the refugees to return home. Since early this year, the agency has been setting up new camps further from the border in areas which are deemed safe from rebel attack. Jeff Worldley is in charge of the operation to relocate tens of thousands of refugees from one of the most threatened areas. I travelled with him on one of the last UN convoys.
Having agreed that the safest thing for the refugees was to move them away from this area, we started an operation about a month ago to relocate the refugees, remaining refugees here. In today's operation, we have 30 of our own trucks and 15 privately hired baggage trucks. This is a sweeping up convoy, basically, to find people. We've informed all the remaining camps, the remaining people, that if they wish to leave, that they present themselves on the road today.
We're on a strip of Guinean territory called the Parrot's Beak, which juts into Sierra Leone. The area has been ravaged by the slash-and-burn agriculture practiced by the refugees. A few years ago, this was dense forest. Today, it's mostly grasslands and tree stumps. Almost 60,000 refugees have been relocated in recent months. The long-term prospects for refugees are still not good, despite the ceasefire in Sierra Leone. Fighting between rebels and government forces has intensified in Liberia, and thousands of new refugees are trying to cross into Guinea. Guineans have been extraordinarily generous towards the refugees over the past 10 years, but their patience is wearing thin. Many now blame the newcomers for bringing war to their country. Another problem that may have very serious long-term effects is the proliferation of weapons. In border areas, the government has given arms to badly trained youths who form defence militias. Mamadou Ba again.
This is dangerous because we never know what will happen after. If they have arms and no money, no food, we have a problem. If they have no money, they will take what they have in the, with the population. I'm sure in a few months or maybe in 1 year, the government will not be able to even feed them. They won't have anything.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rory Mulholland in Conakry, Guinea.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 reporters on four continents and in 14 states are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. They need your support. For more information, go to the strike's website at www.savepacifica.net/strike. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Please tune in again tomorrow for another edition of Free Speech Radio News.